The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio. Hello, John Griffith Cheney, a.k.a. Jack London, was one of the most famous American writers of the early 20th century. Known for his adventurous and highly readable stories, his fame continues to this day thanks to novels like The Call of the Wild and White Fang, and short stories like To Build a Fire, which we read here on the History of Literature podcast. You can find that story in our archives. Less well known, perhaps, are London's political views and his advocacy for animal rights and workers' rights and socialism. He was part of what was called The Crowd, a radical literary group in San Francisco. Much of this part of Jack London's history doesn't get mentioned as much. So too with his second wife, Charmian Kittredge London, who was a great help to Jack, but who deserves to be a part of literary history on her own merits as well. She was herself a writer, an artist, an essayist, and a pioneering woman devoted to political progress and the arts. She was a champion for Jack London's writing when he was alive, and after his death, she became a keeper of his literary flame, chronicling his life and protecting his works and reputation both at home and abroad. She kept her subsequent affairs discreet, including a dalliance she had with none other than Harry Houdini. Charmian Kittredge London, as explained by her biographer Iris Jamal Dunkel, today on the History of Literature. Okay, hello everyone. How are you? I am fine. Let's get started. I'm Jack Wilson, host of the podcast, and we're doing well here in the DC area in this terrible month of March. Looking forward to spring and summer, and what else? Well, I guess that's about it. Spending some time with you. Looking forward to that. We've got a jam-packed show for you today. Up first, we're going to visit with our friend Mike Palindrome, the president of the Literature Supporters Club, who will tell us all about his long-standing passion for the works of Christopher Isherwood, whom you might know as a friend of W.H. Auden or as a writer of the stories that served as the subject for the musical Cabaret. Isherwood was in Berlin in that period between the two wars, and he wrote some excellent fiction about it. Mike's a super fan, and he'll tell us why. And then we'll have our main guest, who will tell us all about another forgotten woman of literature, Charmian Kittredge London. How did she get started? Why was she just the right partner for Jack London? And what did she do to promote literature? And finally today, we'll hear from professor and author Duncan Yoon, who stops by to tell us about his choice for the last book he will ever read. It's short and it's sweet, like me. Except I'm not all that short, or sweet for that matter. Duncan's response is short and it's sweet, like someone you probably know who is not me. Mike Palindrome is next. Okay, Mike, so we're back in the world of authors you've been recommending to me forever, and I've never gotten around to reading them. And we are talking today about Christopher Isherwood. I've always wanted to read him because of his friendship with Auden, who is one of my favorite poets. But you've been recommending him to me, I think, again, since your early 20s. Is that when you discovered Christopher Isherwood?
Yes. And I have pretty much read everything of his, including his California Hedonism when he was in the 70s and 80s.
Right, with Aldous Huxley, and he was sort of like a monk for a while and giving lectures and so on. So what was it that appealed to you about Isherwood?
I think, you know, I was an Anglophile at the time, and he really gave me my fix. He went to Cambridge, so you get the whole Oxbridge stuff and the mores and the manners, just, you know, a rich uncle funding his writing career. I mean, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But then, you know, and the sexual repression and the prudery. But the thing that I found so distinct about him is the way he explored that kind of English behavior and was like such a refreshing voice. I mean, I think, you know, some of the writing I'll quote later on, but just he gave great interviews and the essays he wrote. Like he would say lines like, "I'll bet Shakespeare compromised himself a lot. Anybody who's in the entertainment industry does to some extent."
Yeah.
And I think he was very aware of the sea change going on in the 20s. And I mean, everyone who knows cabaret feels that society was on the cusp of, you know, the brink of fascism and the Third Reich. And, you know, that, so cabaret was based on a play, I Am a Camera, and that play was based on Isherwood's novels, Goodbye, Mr. Norris, and Berlin Stories. And so the way he captured, you know, I talk a lot on the podcast about one great book by a writer, because I acknowledge we all have day jobs. We don't have time to read everything. But I love his entire work, but Berlin Stories is a great representative novel of just the way he viewed the world and the Englishness that I love. And then it's just a great story of Sally Bowles, if people don't know. No, that it's the classic girl with dreams who moves to the city and her adventures. I mean, it clearly, like Breakfast at Tiffany's borrows from that. So many books were influenced by Sally Bowles. So many, I feel like so many writers have tried, set out to try to write a Sally Bowles story. And I just love the transience of it, you know, the bitter end of friendships and the way things always get messed up at the end.
So. Right. And is it, is he a high stylist?
He isn't. And maybe that's why, you know, people, you know, when compared to like other English novelists that were more arch and, you know, like
Evelyn Waugh or P.J. Like, Woodhouse or...
Well, P.J. Woodhouse, I think he just has carved out a space for himself because his plot twists are very original. Like, you know, a wedding ring disappears and then, but he does something very interesting with it. Whereas Isherwood, I think it's, to me, it's the, these little twists in observation that someone who is a bystander, I always like to, the narrator in many of his books is a bystander. And has these very English lines, like someone will say something outrageous and then he'll exclaim like, "Then why on earth all the secrecy?" It's like this, these very English observations that I find very comforting, and why I return to him a lot and why I've read all of his books.
Yeah, right. Okay, so do you want to read a passage?
I don't. I thought I had a passage lined up, but I couldn't pick one in the end. But I will say that, you know, the, his portraits of Berlin and California are incredible. I think a lot of people read them as almost travelogues. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if he ever returned to London. I mean, to England. But he didn't have much love for England, let's just say.
So he went from Germany to the United States, basically, or he might have gone to England here and there, but he basically made his life in the United States after the war.
Yeah, he moved to California, found a boy toy, and they stayed together for like 50 years. Yeah.
Right. So. And it was, yeah, they had a big, like a 30-year difference or something in their age, right?
Yeah, and he welcomed so many writers. He was just a great person to know, incredibly social. I think that's the other thing that really appealed to me is just the energy he had going out every night, albeit as a bystander. But sometimes, you know, a friend remarked, like, when did he have time to write?
Yeah, Right. Well, he didn't write a whole lot, right?
Well, I
not
mean,
like 30 novels or something.
Yeah, no, more like, but he did write like, you know, I think 12 or so.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I mean, he also lived to his, I think, 80s.
Yeah,
I mean,
81, I think.
That's probably a good question, is what is the oldest writer?
Who lived the longest?
Who lived the longest, yeah. Because everybody dies off.
Right.
So early.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I was just doing some Wordsworth, who lived to be 80. And what his biographer said, he had the longest, dullest decline in literary history.
Wow.
So I think one of the things I've always avoided Isherwood for, maybe subconsciously, is he's got such a pedigree. And I was reading one of his ancestors was the Puritan judge, John Bradshaw, who signed the death warrant of King Charles I. And, you know, he's got all of these successes, and he came from money, and he had this, you know, went to all of these fancy schools and everything. And I worry that the snobbery, you have a higher tolerance for snobbery than I do. And I worry that that's going to turn me off.
Yeah, I mean, I think he, because, for instance, Goodbye to Berlin, Berlin Stories, he's in a foreign city, and nobody, one example is nobody picks up on how proper and, you know, his Sloane Henry accent is, you know, they just think he's, you know, a foreigner. There are funny moments when mostly the service industry in Germany will notice how well behaved he is and compliment him.
Mm.
But otherwise, the run of the mill people in Berlin could care less. So I think it's less an issue. I think he definitely knows the range of class. And that, again, is very funny when he spots people trying to act above their class, or are slumming it, you know, as we call it now. But yeah, I mean, I don't think you notice it as much as, say, somebody like John Fowles.
Mm.
With the Magus, I noticed that a little more. My tolerance is very high, though.
Yeah. Now, does it feel that way, the expatriate? I know when he got to Berlin, it was the freedom that it allowed. It was very liberating, and that he could indulge himself with these relationships that were forbidden back home. But does it feel like there's a flattening among the expatriates of class, and that the Brits are kind of all in it together, or do they import a lot of the class system and everything, so that the expatriates are all kind of sniping at one another of here's who you were back home and here's who I expect you to be here?
What I recall is that there aren't that many expats he runs into.
Mm.
He sort of like falls in with Sally, who introduces him to a lot of German friends of hers who are all wealthy, who want to sleep with her. And yeah, I don't want, without giving too much away, but there are a number of hilarious people who pretend to be who they aren't.
Mm.
But he very much, I think this was his style in his essays, he very much tried to immerse himself with the natives and avoided his own type.
Mm. Right. Okay. Well, that appeals to me. So what do you make of the California stint where he was a monk and so on? Is all of that, does it hold up, or is it a little embarrassing, or do you find it meaningful and full of spiritual wisdom, or?
Well, I'm very cynical when it comes to kind of,
yeah.
Even something like meditation, which,
yeah,
but certainly any guru type spirituality. But you know, I think as someone who's not in his 70s and 80s, I guess stranger things do happen, and there is something stunning about the California landscape.
Mm.
So, as someone who's gone out to LA and San Francisco a lot, I can see why. Because a lot of people are like, well, why wouldn't you go to Italy or Greece? I think it is different because California is such an immense mass of land that faces the ocean, and that
Yeah.
it really is like fairly remote, the coast. I mean, there, of course, there are populated areas, but otherwise, you just kind of hike and there's nobody there, which I don't think is the case in Italy.
Yeah. The East Coast and Europe especially are so much denser in population than the Western United States.
Yeah. I mean, I read it because every once in a while he'll reminisce about England and Germany, but I don't think you need to read that. I would, if you're a little hesitant to read Berlin Stories, you should read Prater Violet, which is a novella. I think Hitler has already come to power, and the main character is hired to write a script. It's a little bit like the setup of Contempt. And so he goes to Vienna and to meet with this director who's Jewish. And then, without telling you what happens, like the war is unfolding, and the director is kind of a brilliant buffoon, and it's very funny. You can read it in one sitting.
Okay, so Prater Violet and Goodbye to Berlin.
Berlin Stories, yeah,
Berlin Stories,
they're
you would do the combo of the two.
yeah.
Okay. And that will take us into the world of Christopher Isherwood.
Do it.
Okay, thanks, Mike.
Thanks. Bye.
Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup. And you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week. Whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Okay, joining me now is biographer Iris Jamal Dunkel, who's here to discuss her new book, Charmian Kittredge London, Trailblazer, Author, Adventurer, which tells the story of Jack London's second wife, who was herself a remarkable woman. Iris Jamal Dunkel, welcome to the History of Literature.
Thank you so much. It's so wonderful to be here.
So let's just jump in with Charmian. She was born in 1871. And where was she born and where did she grow up?
Sure. So Charmian was born in 1871 on the mudflats of Wilmington in Southern California. So this is what eventually would become the the LA Harbor. But at the time, it was just completely not populated. But her family moved around a lot. Her dad, Kit, was an entrepreneur, and he would start new businesses. And so they moved from Wilmington up to Petaluma in Northern California, where they ran the American Hotel. Then they moved down. When that burned down, they moved to San Fernando and then down to Los Angeles. But when Charmian's mother got very sick and died when she was 5 years old, and because her father ran, you know, hotels, her aunts thought it wasn't the proper place for a little girl to be raised. And so they sent her up to Oakland to live with her aunt Nanetta.
And she sounds like kind of a remarkable person herself. So who was Netta Wiley, I guess her name is, right?
Yeah, well, she was married to Roscoe Ames, who was actually a friend of Charmian's father. And they were part of this bohemian community in Oakland. And so they had an open marriage. They were vegetarians. They had this holistic approach to health, but they also attended the Unitarian Church in Oakland. And so Charmian in that household was really exposed to a lot of literature. She was exposed to a lot of interesting, like different ways of thinking about gender, different ways of thinking about what it was to be a woman in that time period. You know, we're talking about the 1880s, you know, like the late 1870s, early 1880s. And so she really wasn't raised to think of herself as a proper lady in the sense of the way we usually think about a Victorian age kind of woman.
Shy and retiring and maybe running a household, but definitely kind of being in the background.
Exactly. And that was really never the way that she perceived her role. Like, she actually wasn't really excited about the idea of getting married. And I mean, we can talk about that later when we talk about her career, but these choices of, you know, that women were making during that time period when they had the choice were really weighted in a way that they aren't as much now.
And was she educated at home?
No, she attended school. She attended college. She went to one of the first colleges open to women on the West Coast, Mills College. And she got her bachelor's degree, and then she left school to pursue a job as a stenographer in an office, which was actually a revolutionary job for women at the time.
Yeah, right. So she would have been one of the few women who had gone to college and then one of the few women who had worked in an office, I'm gathering.
Exactly, yeah. So because Mills College was one of the first colleges west of the Rockies, there weren't a lot of women going to college on the West Coast. And so she was really exposed in that environment to all to women from all over the world, because it wasn't just people who went locally. Susan Mills, who ran Mills College, was a world traveler and made her, she had these really strict rules. Like, she taught the women who attended her college how to exercise every day, you know, how they should go on a brisk walk every morning, how they should record every book that they read. So the kind of ingrained in Charmian this discipline towards her education that she would keep her entire life, and her athleticism, which she would keep her entire life. It was really interesting. You don't think of that usually.
Yeah. And did she view herself as an artist? Was she writing or doing any other kinds of art?
So she began writing in her late 20s, in her 20s. Well, she began, like, when she was much younger, she believed in this idea of beauty. Like, beauty was so important to her. Like, her bedroom was a place where she called it her den. And she would decorate it with statues and artwork. And she thought that it was so important to live in a space of beauty. And that was one of her first artistic expressions. Whereas her aunt, Netta, she thought the outside was beauty. Like, she didn't believe that you should keep art in your house, for instance. She thought you should just have a window and that was art, like looking out of it. So Charmian, that was kind of her secret escape, was this creative life where she would think about living a life of beauty. And when she went to Mills College, she really got that reinforced by taking these courses in sculpture, where they would have, you know, reproductions of the Venus de Milo right there in the room. And she would be like, oh, I want to see that someday in Paris. Just the idea of being able to connect with art became very important to her. And it led her to later, when she graduated from college and she started working on her own as a stenographer, she stayed connected with her aunt through her association with the literary magazine, the Overland Monthly, which is one of the most famous Bay Area literary magazines. And her aunt was part of this crowd that ran with Overland Monthly. And they would go on trips, they would go sailing, they would, you know, they were constantly, she was, you know, constantly hanging out with these people. And she wrote several articles for the Overland Monthly, and then would go on to write like for Sunset Magazine and more a literary, you know, she wrote mainly articles at that time in her life, but she always wrote these like sketches, like she called them her beatitudes, the script, sensory rich descriptions of scenes, you know, of beauty.
Right. It sounds almost like, I mean, I guess the time period is kind of overlapping with Oscar Wilde here. Is that kind of connected in this view of, you know, that the purpose of one's life is to, in some sense, be beautiful or to appreciate beauty?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it wasn't that she wanted to be beautiful. It was that she wanted to live in beauty, in a place of beauty. But yes, it totally overlaps.
Yeah. Okay, so let's take a quick break and then we'll talk about what happened when she met Jack London. Okay, we're back. So, Iris, how old was Charmian when she met Jack London?
Well, they met in 1900. They were at the Ferry Building, so she was 29 years old. She'd been working as a stenographer for several years, for many years. She was already quite established, worked for one of the biggest shipping firms in San Francisco, had an assistant that reported to her. And when she went to meet her aunt for lunch at the Ferry Building, you know, her aunt was like, you have to come meet me. I've got this writer I want you to meet. And Charmian was kind of dismissive. She was like, oh my God. First, he was a younger writer. He was not famous at the time. He had come by their house once or twice to just drop off an article because he had started publishing a few articles in the Overland Monthly or a few short stories in the Overland Monthly. And Charmian had caught a look of him, and he was like in his biking outfit and real, like, not a very proper looking gentleman, to say the least. And so Charmian would say to her, she said to her aunt, like, that's your Jack London. Like, and her aunt told her famously, well, once you speak with him, you won't worry about his clothes anymore. So she ended up saying, fine, I'll meet you for lunch. So she gives up her shift to her assistant, goes down to Young's Restaurant, which was across from the Ferry Building before in San Francisco, before the great earthquake. And sat down next to this rough looking sailor guy, and who shook her hand really violently. And she's like, oh my gosh, this is going to be crazy. But as soon as they started talking, she was immediately attracted to his mind. Like, they had an immediate intellectual attraction, and they started swapping stories about books because Charmian was always a voracious reader. Her mother was a writer. Netta was a writer. Their houses were filled with books at all times. Like, books were the most important thing that you could have. And so Jack London immediately started asking her, hey, do you have any, like, trying to get these banned books? Because he doesn't have access to any books. He can only get them through the library. And the library doesn't have banned books. And so he's like, do you have Tessa d'Urberville's? Like, you know, because it's, you know, that's a crazy book. Can you get it for me? She's like, of course I have it. Just come by, you know, come by my den. And I'll lend it to you. And he was like, oh, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And so they really hit it off immediately. And so they started seeing each other after that luncheon. He would come by her den. They would, you know, have conversations about the literature that he borrowed from her. How they really, really connected was in that space, in that room that she had really curated as this beauty, this place of beauty, with her piano, you know, her scarves draped everywhere, her little miniature statues. He got it. He was like, he appreciated the beauty in a way that no other man that she'd come in contact with. And she is constantly dating men, and they would want to get engaged. And she would be like, no, I'm not leaving my job for you. And so she met Jack London, and they had this connection that she was like, wow, this is the most connected I've ever felt to someone. Yeah. And it turns out, leaving that meeting, he asked her if she would review his book. And so when his first novel came out, it was sent to her, and she sat down at her little dressing table and opened up the sheath and started reading it. And she sat there, read it cover to cover, and told her aunt, there is no way I can review it. It's the best writing I've ever read. So she just immediately, she was just like, wow, I've met one of the most brilliant minds I've ever met. And it just floored her.
Yeah. And when you say they hit it off, it sounds like he maybe appreciated her attitude toward beauty, even if he wasn't expressing that himself in his own outfits and decor and so on. But they probably also, it seems like he also was someone who could appreciate that women could be independent, and the more bohemian attitudes of free love and some other progressive views.
Exactly. So, I mean, he considered her, as the relationship did progress later, he considered her his mate. And mate is a word that they would use to call each other. And she considered him her mate, because he thought of her in the way that he would think about, say, George Sterling, like somebody which was his best literary friend, someone who he could completely connect with on a intellectual level, but he also felt completely physically attracted to her. But that happens later.
And we should also probably say that there is the issue of his wife.
Yes. So when they met, he wasn't married yet. So they're going to her den, you know, they've got a date to go. He didn't know how to ride a horse at the time, which is pretty funny. And so Charmian was an avid rider. She actually devised a special skirt, because at the time women rode cross saddle. So they rode, you know, sitting side saddle on a horse, which he was like, that's ridiculous. How am I going to gallop through the hills? You know? So she was like, she got a men's saddle, and just like, you couldn't buy pants at the time. So she just cut her skirt in half and sewed it into culottes, right? So she could gallop through the hills. And so she would ride on, you know, from Oakland all the way to Yosemite, you know, multi-day rides. It was just really what she did on her weekends. And when she met Jack, she was like, we've got to go horseback riding. And so she set up this date. And then a few, like before they, it was like 2 weeks away or something like that. And she got a message via her aunt. He had sent a letter to Nanetta that said, you know, I'm really sorry, but I'm not going to be able to meet Charmian, and I'm going to not be able to hang out with you guys for a little while because I just got married last Sunday. And they were like, what? It was just completely out of the blue. But part of the reason why is because the way that Jack London thought about marriage at that time, like, he wasn't looking for someone like Charmian. He was looking for somebody who he thought would be a good mother to raise children, who would manage a household, who would manage him and make sure that he would keep himself together so that he would keep on his writing schedule. So he knew that wasn't Charmian. That wasn't their connection at all. And so when that happened, she was like, okay, I guess we're not together anymore. You know, they hadn't really connected in that way. But it was definitely leading that direction. But once he got married, she was like, okay.
And then, but he, I guess everyone believing in free love and so on, he maybe thought, well, this doesn't necessarily rule out the possibility that Charmian and I will eventually have an affair. And that is what happened.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, that was what really happened was, after Jack London got married, Charmian was like, you know what, I need to go see the world. And so she got on a train, went to, her father was from Maine. And so she went to stay with, to meet all of her relatives she'd never met. And then traveled to Europe with friends, traveled all over Europe and wrote about it. And then when she came back, she got invited to Jack London's famous crowd. He had his group of friends were called The Crowd. And he had these famous dinners at his house in the Berkeley Hills. And she got invited to come on by. And so she did. And Jack was like her, who believed in, I don't think she was the first woman that he stepped out of his relationship with his wife for, would be the nice way of saying it. So when she came to one of the parties, this was in 1902, so 2 years after they met, she's back in the Bay Area, and he asked her if she wanted to fence. You know, they had all the fencing gear, and when she was at Mills College, she had learned how to fence. Like, they learned they did a lot of exercise at Mills College. So she was really good at it. And Charmian's not one that would have been like, oh, I'll let Jack win, you know?
Yeah.
So she put on the gear and she won. And he was like so impressed that he like ran over and kissed her. And that was like kind of the first kiss that they had. And it was a sparks flew, as they say. And it started a covert relationship that, you know, between the two of them. And that went on for quite some time until it couldn't go on that way any longer.
Right. And then did he attempt to impose his views of marriage on Charmian, or did he just accept, well, this, maybe I was wrong to think that a wife is different from a lover, and Charmian is not someone who's going to now raise my children and stay at home and do all that kind of thing?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that once she did become Jack London's eventual fiance and wife, she did leave her job and she did manage everything, you know, his career, and it did hinder the work that she was able to do. And it took her a long time, like until 1907, when they were on the snark journey, until she was able to say, hey, wait a second, I want to get back to me. I want to get back to my career, and I'm going to start writing again. And that's, so it was a good couple of years before she was able to switch back into her independence. But it was what attracted him at first. But Jack London was somebody who was really charismatic, and she was mad in love with him. And he, by the time that they met, he had published The Call of the Wild. So The Call of the Wild, he wrote it while they were together, and he was writing The Sea Wolf. They actually started working on that together, and he was world famous, and he was so famous, like the paparazzi would follow them around.
Yeah.
When they got married, they were in Chicago, and the reporters were like all over the hotel where they stayed. Like, they were trying to catch a picture of Jack London and his new wife.
Right. And she had such respect for his writing. So in some ways, you know, if you've read something and you think this is the greatest book I've ever read, and then he comes out with books that are even better, you feel like, you know, she probably felt like she was part of something special and important to be helping him with his career. Was she typing or editing or helping him generate ideas, or did she have a role like that in his writing?
Yes. So beginning with The Sea Wolf, she helped with first typing. So this is when she left her job as a stenographer, is when she started working on The Sea Wolf with him. She also edited. And then slowly she started being, they would work together planning stories. So she saw herself as part of the literary team. But then when it got to The Valley of the Moon, which they wrote while they were on board, they researched for several years and then wrote on board the Dirigo in 1912. She actually wrote large portions of that book, the parts that are, when I was a child, I read it. And it was like, one of the reasons why I fell in love with Jack London's writing is because he depicted women so well. I was like, wow, this is the first like early 1900s writer that's a male writer that's written a woman that's believable to me. And then I discovered the reason why is because Charmian wrote those parts.
Right.
So that makes sense.
Yeah, right. And he was wise enough to include it.
Yeah, he was. You know, he was very wise to include it. And, you know, we really have to think about this in the terms of how authorship was thought about during this time period, like this idea of individual genius that we have now. It really wasn't the case. Like, she considered herself part of his like literary team. And so she did not feel bad that she was contributing to these books. She didn't feel taken advantage of in any way. She just didn't like that she didn't have time for her own work.
Right. And were they generally happy when they were together?
They were. I think Jack London was a difficult person to be married to. Even if you were madly in love with him, she kept a very, she kept a diary her entire life up until the 1940s. And there are many passages where she's complaining about Jack, especially when he's on his drinking binges or, you know, he's off at the hijinks at the Bohemian Grove, or he's not there for her in her times of need. Like when they had one child together, who her name was Joy, and she died after 38 hours. And after that, Charmian was devastated and was suffering from a deep depression. And she was on her own for a lot of that and had many miscarriages after that because of the damage that was done from that live birth. And that was really lonely for her, definitely. But she adored him. She still, like, even after he died, she would still think of him in that same way of they had their tumultuous times, but she was madly in love with him throughout it all.
So, yeah, that takes us to sort of the act three of her life, when Jack London died very young, the age of 40. And I guess she was a few years older.
Yes.
So she was young as well. And then she kind of came into her own, I guess I would say, as a legacy keeper of Jack London. So what did she help do and how did she occupy herself doing it?
Well, first I want to establish that before he died, those years before, she published her first book on her own, The Log of the Snark, which was about their journeys through the South Seas on the small yacht that they commissioned to build. And so she was identifying as a writer and she published two books on Hawaii after that, and then also a biography about Jack London, which was a really tough thing for her to do as a widow.
Yeah, The Book of Jack London.
Yeah, which is a two-volume.
What exactly was that, and what picture of Jack emerges from this biography by his widow?
So as soon as Jack died, she started working on his legacy. She started publishing everything that he, you know, he had so many projects going, he didn't expect to die. And so she got everything published that he hadn't published, kept things in print. But the one thing that he had asked her as he was, you know, getting sicker and sicker was to, you know, keep this story of himself, do the marketing of him, you know, as this adventurous person. And they had the idea of who his father was very, you know, his father was not John London who raised him. He was actually this man named Cheney that just didn't want to be his father. And so he didn't want that to come out. He didn't want all of, you know, all these other things to come out. And so he asked Charmian to control the story. And so she had a lot of pressure on her to write that book. It's a 2-volume biography. And the first volume is thick with the story that Jack wanted her to tell, the story that they, you know, the marketing of Jack London. The second volume, though, is really personal and goes through, you know, like the scenes where she talks about him dying and his death are so heart-wrenching. Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons why I was drawn to this project is because I read that book. I didn't know who Charmian was as well before. You know, I was a Jack London fan and I hadn't read, when you go to the park, you don't see Charmian Kittredge London featured there. You didn't when I was growing up here. And so when I read that book and I read the picture of Jack London she paints in The Book of Jack London, I was like, oh, wow, this is amazing writing. Like, this is exactly who I imagined him to be. And I've never perceived him this way in other biographies. And so it really drew me to find out who she was, because she clearly loved him and knew him.
And it gives you a different view of her than how she had appeared in other biographies.
Oh, yes. So, I mean, the another reason why I was drawn to the project is because of her depiction in Sailor on Horseback by Irving Stone, which was kind of the Jack London biography that was circulating in the 70s and 80s when I was reading biographies about Jack London. And it's still in print today. It is called a fictional biography now. But because of the way he depicted her as this kind of airhead who hindered her husband's life more than helped it, she got kind of depicted that way everywhere. No one dug any deeper to try to change the story. And the reason why is because when she was working, so after Jack died, Irving Stone came to the, you know, this is when she's in her 60s, Irving Stone came to the ranch, you know, he asked her to, if he could write this biography, and she was really excited to have a famous writer come and write about Jack London. You know, it would really hopefully keep his name alive, which was her sole purpose. And he took her out dancing. He was in his 30s and he like wined and dined her, you know, he made her feel like she was special in a way that she hadn't felt in a while. And because of that, he convinced her to sign away her rights to both her story, to his story, and to hers.
Mm.
And so she could do nothing legally once he started publishing this version of the story. He had made it seem like they were going to be a literary partnership, which is something she understood with, you know, she's like, oh, that's just the way it was with Jack, and we'll talk about the project together. And no, he just wanted full control of the story so that he could write a sensational biography that would sell a lot of books. And that's exactly what he did.
Mm. Villainous.
Yeah. That's where I begin my story, because I had to begin the book with that moment of why it was that we didn't know who Charmian was, and why it was that when I went to the park when I was middle school and I discovered Jack London, I knew nothing about Charmian Kittredge London.
Yeah.
Because she wasn't featured there. She is now, though.
It really kind of diminishes them both. Both her and Jack, to have it be that, you know, she's this airhead, bossy, needy wife who's tying him down and holding him back and all of that. It might have exercised some demons that Irving Stone wanted to exercise. But if it's not reality, not the true picture, it, you know, I like the Jack London who is drawn to this woman who can beat him at fencing. And who is excited about being with someone who's got copies of books that are banned that she reads as a matter of course that he wants to get his hands on. And, you know, to view them more as a partnership, and that he could draw from her creativity and her artistic sensibility and all of that makes him a bigger figure as well. It doesn't seem to diminish him or, you know, what I'm trying to say here, it's like I feel like it was maybe Irving Stone's way of taking her down in order to build up Jack, but I think it kind of does the opposite.
Totally agree. Yeah. And what's shocking is how that image stuck. So she did kind of limit what people could tell about her after Irving Stone published this book. She like she burned a lot of her letters. She locked away her belongings, like everything, her side of the story, basically at the Huntington Library, and very few people could get access to it. And so what happened was Irving Stone's story about her kept being repeated in all of the biographies. And when I was, you know, I found this photograph of Jack London on a hillside. It's like this famous photograph. If you Google Jack London, it'll come up. It's him riding a horse on Sonoma Mountain in Sonoma County. And it's the cover of many of one of the most famous Jack London biographies that's recently been written it's called Jack London in American Life. And it's by Earl Laver. And Earl was an amazing scholar, wonderful guy. And so when I found that photograph, I contacted him. I'm like, hey, did you know? Because I found this photograph and it said photo by Charmian Kittredge London. Like it was very clearly she had taken it. And I went to him and I asked him, I'm like, did you know that she took this photograph? And he said, no, actually, I never thought to ask who took it. What else do we not know about Charmian's life or about Jack London's life for that matter? Because we didn't look through her perspective. We didn't look at Jack London through, you know, the person who was by his side the whole time. And who was she, you know? So answering that question took me about 6 years.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And like, for example, when did it come out that she had also had an affair with Harry Houdini?
So she was not married when she had her relationship with Harry Houdini, but he was. So he was having an affair, I guess.
Oh,
you know,
right,
she
right.
was just hooking up with him. Just to be clear.
Okay.
But yeah, she met Harry Houdini when Jack was still alive. So he did a show in Oakland and they went and Jack was brought up on stage. They instantly became good friends with the Houdinis and they had Thanksgiving together afterwards. And then after Jack died, Harry sent a letter to Charmian just with his condolences. And he invited her to New York. And she was going to New York anyways to meet with Brett, who was Jack London's publisher. And that's when they were talking about her writing the biography, The Book of Jack London. And so when she went to New York, she went to Harry Houdini's show and at the Hippodrome. And it was like she was in the front row, and she went to his dressing room afterwards, and he's like, oh, you have to come to dinner with me and my wife. And she did. But soon after that, he was inviting her, you know, to meet up with him. And they ended up having this affair, you know, for several weeks. The diary entries have been much publicized, but usually from the perspective of Harry, as usual. But the idea is that he fell madly in love with her. You know, they had a brief but passionate affair. And she just decided, because he was a lot like Jack London. He was like to be the center of attention, really intense personality. And she was like, I'm not doing this again, you know, like, and you're married. Like, so she just left him in New York and went back to California a couple of weeks later. But she left some really interesting diary entries where in one of the entries, she calls him her magic lover. And, you know, so it's been well documented, but the truth is that she wasn't looking for someone, you know, really to have to step behind the shadow of anymore. You know, she was ready. She wanted to be more independent in this part of her life. And so she didn't end up pursuing a relationship with Harry Houdini, but she did care for him and like him a lot.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about celebrity. It's intoxicating, but there's also a kind of tendency that they have to let others kind of pick up the pieces and support them. And so having gone through that once, I can see why she was reluctant to pursue it further with the great Harry Houdini.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think there would definitely have been paparazzi involved with him as well.
Yeah, right. This is such a great story. Has Hollywood found you yet?
Not yet, but I'm willing to take offers.
Okay, yeah. That it just seems like a perfect, I mean, I would say a film today. Maybe it would be a Netflix series or something, because there is so much richness here. And it's definitely, you know, you could imagine any number of actors and actresses in their 20s and 30s who would just love to jump into these parts.
Totally. Yes, it would be amazing to see it reenacted in that way.
Okay. Well, when that happens, we'll have you back and we can talk about your views of the film and what they got right and if you're allowed to.
Yes. And what I was wearing on the red carpet.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah. We could do a call from the red carpet. You'll give us a call.
There
and
we
give
go.
Us the, tell us who's there and what everyone's wearing and all that. It'll be a first for the History of Literature podcast.
I love it.
Okay. The book is called Charmian Kittredge London, Trailblazer, Author, Adventurer, Iris Jamal Dunkel. Thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
And finally today, Duncan Yoon, who told us about China in 20th and 21st century African literature. After our discussion about that, I asked him a special question. Okay, we're joined now by Duncan Yoon, expert in globalization and literature and author of the book, China in 20th and 21st Century African Literature. Duncan, this question comes from a listener who asks, what do you want your last book to be? This will be the last book you will ever read. You can either choose one that exists or describe one that has not yet been written.
Well, actually, I think I would rather not read it, but I would like it to be read to me. You know, like when you're a kid, your child, bedtime stories, that's the first way we encounter story.
Yeah.
And so I think I would like to return to the way I first heard story. And it would just, it would probably be my mom when I was little, to keep me quiet in the car and keep me occupied, would record nursery rhymes and different, you know, novels on a tape back when cars had tape decks. And she would put it in. And one of the ones that she would read was T.H. White's Idylls of the King. And so I think I would want to hear my mom reading me T.H. White's Idylls of the King.
Do you still have that cassette?
Oh yeah, she just well, not the cassette, but she sent me the MP3 of it.
Oh right, okay. So you can actually tee this one up and play it. Yeah, play it when you need it.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, excellent, Duncan Yoon. Thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thank you.
Okay, there we go. That's going to do it for this episode of The History of Literature. My thanks to Mike Palindrome, Iris Jamal Dunkel, and Duncan Yoon. I told you that was short and sweet, didn't I? And did I say it's March? It's April now, isn't it? For you, anyway, it's March when I'm recording this. April when you're listening. One step closer, month by month, day by day. Not sure what we're getting closer to, unless it's our look at Alejandro Jodorowsky. Or Dr. Johnson, or Thomas Hardy. And a curious episode coming up. We have one all about a castle and the role that it has played in literature. Kind of an interesting angle on our story of the history of literature. And we have an excellent discussion on Emerson with an old friend and Tove Jansson. You say Jansson? Jansson? The creator of the Moomin Trolls. How about John Buchan, author of The 39 Steps, and Upton Sinclair, author of The Jungle? We're going to hear about mad women in literature soon, and necromantics. So you can see, we are not running out of topics. Happy April, everyone. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.